Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joseph Huff. I'm a deputy public defender, and I'm representing the defendant, James Priest. My registration number is 34384. I think that the Attorney General and I would both agree that this case really comes down to Williams and Hill. And we both, in our briefs, went over the facts of those cases and analyzed it. And the Attorney General's argument is essentially that this case is more like Hill. My argument is it's more like Williams and is significantly distinguishable from Hill. So what I'm going to spend the majority of my time on is just comparing the facts and the relevant analysis in Hill to the facts of this case at issue. So the reason I think that this is more like Williams and less like Hill is that Williams was essentially the same thing that happened here, except that the entire report came in from someone who did not do the presumptive test on the crack cocaine and did not weigh the crack cocaine. In this case, we have half of that issue, which is we had the person that did the presumptive test on the crack cocaine, but he had no clue as to how the weight was calculated. Another person who had left the office, in my case, had done the presumptive weight, and the witness in this case had no knowledge of the actual weight, but had only done the presumptive test to determine that the substance was, in fact, cocaine.
Didn't he just do a verifying test so that he could testify to the test, or did he do the original test?
He did.
As to whether it was cocaine or not.
I believe she might have done a presumptive test as well, but he either retested it or did the original presumptive test.
I don't know which.
I'm not sure. What's relevant, in my opinion, is that he never had anything to do with the weighing of the crack cocaine. Testing, I agree. And had this case simply boiled down to possession under a gram, this would not be an issue. We wouldn't be here because he tested.
Well, let me ask you about that.
Yes, sir.
Surely we agree with you.
Yes, sir.
Would the appropriate remedy be to remand with directions to enter judgment on the lesser included felony six?
You know, I thought about that and I've come to the conclusion that that's not an adequate remedy. And the reason is because the issue of knowing possession was also fundamental to the case. And the prosecutor argued that by virtue of the weight of the crack cocaine here, that there's no way he could not have knowingly possessed it. We argued this wasn't his. He didn't know it was down there in the floorboard. It was someone else's, presumably.
And in the retrial, if there is one, that evidence is going to come in, presumably. The weight will
yes.
come in. And then you'll still have the same problem.
Well, but it would be... At that point, we would have been allowed to cross-examine the appropriate person. If the weight comes in through the person who actually did the weighing, then we would be allowed to cross that person. Well, how did you weigh this? Did you calibrate the scale properly? How old is the scale? How often do you use the scale? Was this the first time you've used the scale? Was this cocaine weighed by itself? Was there packaging? If so, how much did the packaging weigh? The jury could, based upon the answer to those questions, determine that the weight was inaccurate, it was under a gram, or that it was so little that
these experienced technicians weigh this stuff all the time. I bet that technician can tell you within a tenth of an ounce how much cocaine there was there without weighing it.
Well, and that's what I would like to find out. And we've seen hundreds of cases like this, and of course, you know, that would be our assumption. But jury trials aren't based on assumption, they're based on proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And if we were able to put some doubt in the jury's mind as to how much this actually
But then they would come back in your best scenario at the felony six, possession of less than a gram.
Well, not necessarily, because they might find that the weight was less than seven, and that didn't indicate knowing possession. You see, the prosecutor's argument was, look, we have so much cocaine here. We have 7 grams. There's no way he didn't know that was down there. It was worth $300. However, if it was a lesser amount, then we could argue it's not $300. It's some amount lesser. The prosecution based Well, certainly based its case about intent to distribute based upon the weight. That was a large part of the case. But the prosecutor also argued, we argued there was no knowing possession. And the prosecutor argued, wait a minute, there's no way that if you have 7 grams of cocaine, that there's not knowing possession. That amount in and of itself evidences knowing possession. So if we could cross-examine the person that weighed that and put doubt in the jury's mind as to actually how much that weighed, they could very well find it wasn't enough to evidence knowing possession.
What if we were remanded and give the prosecution the choice of whether to take a felony six or go to trial?
Well,
same objection?
I would object to that. I mean, I don't think that that's altogether unfair, given the facts. But like I said, the prosecution's case was based upon the amount. The amount was everything, because the amount evidenced his knowing possession, which is an element of even possession under a gram. Possession of any amount requires knowing possession. And fundamental to their case was this weight in and of itself evidences knowing possession. So if we don't have someone who could testify as to the weight, which we shouldn't have had here, then all the jury would have heard is, I tested an amount of crack cocaine, an amount of substance that was given to me from the defendant's vehicle, and it tested positive for crack cocaine. From that testimony alone, the jury could have found that there wasn't knowing possession. It was the weight, it was the testimony as to the weight that was critical to proving up the entire case here. And like I said, I just want to spend a little bit of time distinguishing this from the Hill case, because that's what the prosecutor or the attorney general primarily relies on. Unlike in Hill, this was manually tested by someone, and we know who manually tested it. It was an M.J. Thomas who didn't testify. Unlike Hill, there wasn't an actual person doing the testing. This was a machine, and the person who actually analyzed the results of the machine is the only one that testified, and the only person that could testify as to the results. This is entirely different. Had Butler, in this case, the person who actually testified, had he only reweighed it, we wouldn't be here. It wouldn't be a problem. But he didn't reweigh it. He wasn't even there. I could even concede that if he was there with MJ Thomas watching her weigh it, that that would probably be enough. But he wasn't even there to verify any of that. He couldn't tell us anything about the scale, anything about whether it had been recently calibrated, anything about the packaging, whether it was weighed with or without packaging, or anything of that nature. He had no idea. The only thing he had done was found that it was, in fact, crack cocaine.
So, anything in the record indicating why MJ Thomas was not called?
Yes, the prosecutor indicated that she had retired from the CBI lab, and for whatever reason, they made no effort to secure a presence at trial.
Maybe moved to Paris.
Could be, I don't know. It's a possibility. The second issue also ties into the weight, because if you'll recall, the second issue involves one of the jurors who went back to deliberate worked at a rehab center, and he talked with one of his buddies at the rehab center who was an ex-crack cocaine addict. And that person had informed him that given the weight, almost 7 grams in this case, that that clearly was not for personal use, couldn't even be used by a normal crack user in a week, that it was much more consistent with distribution than it was personal use. This is just going to be a case-by-case determination, because there's no way to really know for certain how much this weighed into the jury's decision. Yes, Detective Ettinger testified essentially to the same thing, but was this extraneous information enough to tip the balance? At least for this one juror, she felt she was bullied into the verdict, And perhaps without this information, she would have found that it would have been a hung jury or something to that effect. So I think given the fact that the extraneous information was directly on point to the heart of the case, to the heart of the matter, which was the weight and whether it was consistent with distribution or personal use, I think there's really no way to argue that this it didn't at least have the reasonable possibility of prejudice. And that's all it takes. It doesn't take a reasonable probability of prejudice, only the possibility. And I think in this case, it's very clear that given the fact that the weight was the heart of the matter, any extraneous information going to that and showing that that weight is consistent with intent to distribute would be of reasonable possibility to prejudice the jury, in other words. And if there are no other questions, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
So you have Thunder for me. Well, you know what my questions are, right? Somewhere along the way, address them, would you?
I would love to do so. May it please the court, my name is Coral Spettigue, registration 39208. I represent the people in this matter. I would agree that turning to the defendant's first issue, the real issue here turns on whether Mr. Butler's testimony was sufficient to satisfy the statute 16.3309, subsection 5. The people would like to kind of reframe it a little bit, though, because really it kind of boils down to, does every individual who may have contributed to a lab report, however minor their contribution, have to testify in order to satisfy the defendant's confrontation rights?
Let me rephrase that or reframe it just a little bit differently.
Okay.
Does everybody who testifies to part of a lab report dealing with an element of a crime have to testify?
Well, my argument here is that while this did deal with an element of the crime, this is very akin to People v. Hill, because in that case, we had a situation where Mr. Fischinger, I believe was his name, the doctor who ultimately generated the report. Now, this is what Hill found, was that the person who generates the report is the one who needs to testify. Granted, you know, there's room for interpretation as to who generates the report when other people are contributing. But in Hill, I think it's very important to note that the employee of the lab who prepared the defendant's sample for testing by the GCMS machine, this included that he had to add a buffer to the urine sample, pour it into the solid phase extraction, elute the SPE, transfer the extract to dry down, add a derivatizing agent, and transfer the sample to a vial for the GS. So there's all these transfers and additions and all these things happening pre Mr. Fischinger having any analysis of the sample, all of which technically could be cross-examined on, and this court found that it wasn't necessary for that technician to testify.
Was chain of custody issues, and does chain of custody have to be perfect?
Well, no, but I would say that those are also, you know, it's analogous to, okay, well, did you put the sample on the scale? How was the sample on the scale? Did you have it in this or out of the vial? You know, these kinds of things would be very comparable in terms of what this technician had to do prior to the lab technician here, Mr. Butler, generating his report, in terms of handling, in terms of the many different ways that perhaps the defendant could have cross-examined this technician, is analogous to the very many different ways the defendant in Hill could have cross-examined the technician who was found not necessary for testimony in terms of admitting the lab report. So, you know, going further with that analogy, the facts here would be similar, as that Mr. Butler was admitted as an expert in the field. He testified that he had done the final analysis in this case, that he had created the report as evidenced by his name appearing at the bottom. He relied on the preliminary testing. That's how he characterized it, preliminary testing done by MJ Thomas, and that she had prepared the sample and waited. But to the extent that that was all that she did, he was able to complete the final analysis, determine that it was a cocaine base with a total net weight of 6.805 grams, and then conducted a confirmatory analysis, whatever that means. They didn't really go further than that, and the cross-examination didn't seem to expand on that definition of what
it's true that the defendant had no ability to cross-examine anyone who'd been involved in the weighing, and that was a critical element of the intent to distribute charge, wasn't it?
Was your question, is it true?
was no ability to cross-examine the person who did the weighing, and the weight was a critical element of the offense.
I guess that would be a true statement in that the MJ Thomas said who did the weighing was not available, was not there to testify, and therefore he could not cross-examine her.
How does Bo Comey versus New Mexico come into play? Are you familiar with that case, counsel?
I am. I actually just kind of looked it over this morning. That case, if you'll give me just a moment, has to do with whether the Confrontation Clause permits the prosecution to introduce a forensic laboratory report containing a testimonial certification made in order to prove a fact at a criminal trial through the in-court testimony of an analyst who did not sign the certification or personally perform or observe the performance of the test reported in the certification. So to the extent that I think Bo Comey is a little more like Williams in that that person had zero involvement in the testing of the lab report, the ultimate analysis done in the lab report, I think that's where it diverges a little bit. However, I did want to note for this court that in looking over a few cases this morning, I noticed that we are up on cert here in the Colorado Supreme Court in a case called Marshall v. People. It was granted on March 19th of 2012, and that case will be considering whether, in light of Bo Comey, the appearance of a laboratory supervisor that reviewed and approved test results completed by another technician is sufficient to satisfy the Confrontation Clause of the United States Constitution, and also whether the appearance of a lab supervisor, you know, in the same vein, is sufficient to satisfy our statute.
Was Mr. Butler examined concerning the weight?
He was asked, and he stated that he had not been involved in weighing the...
And he could not provide any testimony concerning how that was done?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And he stated as such in his testimony, and they definitely highlighted that in cross-examination. So... essentially, it comes down to this court either considering whether Hill or Williams more applies. I would argue, obviously, our position is that Hill is more akin to the preliminary testing done in this case, the weight. However, if this court is so inclined, you could also wait and see how this Marshall case plays out in this Colorado Supreme Court as it applies Bo Comey and, you know, its brethren.
What stage is Marshall?
It looks like cert was just granted March 19th of this year. So it'll be a little bit. Mm-hmm. It might be a little while.
We're not likely to wait.
All right. There's no further questions on that issue. I'd like to move on to the second.
Can I ask one last question on that? And that is, you know, you said kind of like, okay, no involvement in preliminary testing. Was preliminary testing essentially the result of essentially final testing when it comes down to the as far as weight goes? There was no further testing on the weight of the material, was there?
No, there was not. He said that it was only tested the one time when it comes into the CBI lab. So it seems like in this situation, what happened was Stewart. She was originally assigned the case, retired, and it was transferred over to our Mr. Butler, who then, you know, finished the case, generated the report, and testified at the defendant's trial.
One of the reasons we're not going to wait for Marshall is I retire in November.
Which makes sense. If you really want it off your desk. Okay, moving on to the second issue. The people again concede that an error occurred here. There was extraneous information admitted to the jury. However, we submit that the error was harmless. After the defendant's trial, it was alleged that by juror M that another juror had brought in extraneous information, essentially stating in her affidavit that this other juror works at a drug rehab center. He had spoken with an ex-crack addict who told him that, quote, it was unlikely that anybody would consume that much crack in 7 days and things of that nature, and, quote, that you couldn't use that much drugs and that it would be used for selling on the street. So the defendant argues now that this was reversible error, the omission of this extraneous information. But I'd like to point out that to reverse, you'd have to find two different things. Obviously, there was extraneous information here, so that part of the test is satisfied. The issue here is whether or not this really posed a reasonable probability of prejudice.
Probability or possibility?
Pardon?
Probability or possibility?
Probability of prejudice.
What case would you cite to us with that test that applies to essentially the 606B inquiry later?
I have People v. Holt and People v. Harlan. Holt being 266 P3rd 442 and People v. Harlan 109 P3rd 616. Both, I believe, are cited in my brief as well. Prejudice is considered under an objective test, which requires the court to determine that the influence improperly introduced, that what influence the improperly introduced extraneous information might have had on a typical jury, the relevant question being whether there is a reasonable probability that the extraneous information influenced the verdict to the detriment of the defendant. So here, as the district court found, we had Detective Edinger, you know, testifying at length about how much the amount of cocaine found on the defendant really spoke to how this was a distribution amount. He stated that typically people that are addicted to crack have a hard time keeping it around and they have to sell to maintain their habit. He talked about how the drugs found in his vehicle was a pretty good amount and that it was definitely within the realm of distribution.
Why would the juror have asked someone at the, this ex-addict about this issue if he didn't think there was an issue about it?
You know, who knows why jurors do what they do, but I would argue that he was trying to contribute to the deliberations and
trying to contribute to the deliberations. In other words, to tilt the deliberations one way or the other, to inform the other jurors.
He was, as a drug rehab center employee, he thought he had something to contribute. And so I think the issue here, though, is whether it was a reasonable probability that it tipped the jurors over in a different
way. What do we mean by reasonable probability? 51%? Or do we mean kind of like, it's enough to make ourselves a little queasy as to whether or not it tipped the balance?
I think reasonable means reasonable. So would you think that the defendant, if there's a witness who is already testifying for 45 minutes to an hour about the same issue, and then this other person just kind of, you know, adds to it by confirming the same information, if we're already there, then why would that be a reasonable probability that they would tip them over further?
How about this? The information is essentially sponsored by one of the decision makers. Does that up the ante a little bit? In other words, it doesn't just plop down in front of the jury. It's brought to the jury by one of the members of the jury.
Which I would argue is a peer who doesn't really hold any greater weight or significance than the witness himself.
He's a decision maker. He's part of the decision-making process.
Agreed. And I would say that, you know, to the extent that any juror comes to the jury room with some sort of personal experience and uses that as a contributing factor in their deliberations.
It wasn't his personal experience. He got it after he started sitting down, after he started sitting on this jury.
True, but it was within his capacity as, you know, an employee of this rehab center, and so it can kind of be framed as his personal experience talking to somebody that he's worked with, you know, in the capacity of his position.
What if I just go out on the street and start talking with my neighbor? It's my personal experience because I talk with my neighbor and I, you know, get his opinions and his ideas. Can I bring those back into the jury room with me?
I think the big issue here was that he did this during the deliberations. I think that was where, if he had done this, well, he claims later on that he did it a week before, and so that then it would have been fine, because then it would have been his own personal experiences, his own, you know, interactions with somebody that he could have brought into the room.
Right. If during deliberations I went to talk to my neighbor and I ask his opinion about certain things, can I come back in and say, hey, you know, there's somebody else who has this opinion that may help us decide this case?
Yes, and that's extraneous information, absolutely. We're not arguing that this wasn't incorrect.
That's what I'm talking about, though, isn't there a reasonable probability that could have tipped a balance?
Well, I would argue no. I think that to the extent that Detective Edinger spoke to the same issue at length, you know, for quite some time during his testimony, I don't believe you can ring the bell again. I think the jurors got that message. They understood it. This juror...
Does a juror have to believe a detective? Is a juror bound to accept the detective's testimony?
No, but I would say that it came from a more, you know, legitimate source, being that he was a witness brought by...
For one side of the case.
And they were both instructed. Everybody was instructed that he was, you know, to believe or disbelieve any of the witnesses, and that, you know, they were... The witness's credibility is up to them to decide.
So they were free to disbelieve the expert's testimony?
Correct.
But according to you, they really couldn't, because after all, it was 45 minutes of expert testimony.
No, but I would say that they did believe his testimony, because all of the jurors, except for Juror M, seemed to be on board with convicting the defendant until the point later on in the trial when she, I guess she had some difficulty. There was some exchange with the bailiff about she was the one holdout essentially, and she said she didn't, you know, she wasn't sure what she wanted to do, and so there was some conflict in the jury room based on this, and then she ended up flipping her vote towards the end.
Okay. I agree with your opposing counsel on the first issue. Do we have to address the second one?
Well, the first one, it depends on the remedy that
we're down to 42 seconds. You haven't talked about that yet.
Okay. Well, I guess it is reversible error. The first issue is reversible error, and so this would go back for retrial and or if this court saw fit for the lesser included, depending on how you wanted to do it. So if it was a retrial, I guess no, it would be moot because that would also be.
Why would there even be the possibility of a DA having the choice of entering judgment on lesser
included? I
understand. I'm asking you. Why would there be that possibility of entering judgment on the lesser included offense if, as defense counsel has asserted, the prosecution tied the amount also to the knowing element of the possession?
Well, I mean, there was other evidence. There was evidence that the defendant. I'm sorry, I see my time is up. Would judge me continue?
I would ask that the presiding judge allow her to continue.
You're the only case this morning.
Okay.
Lunch is still.
We're not going to lunch.
I visited the Australian courts a couple of years ago, and they don't have any time limit on argument.
At all.
They just go until everybody drops. Go ahead, answer the question, and there may be others.
Okay. I believe that at trial, it was also introduced that the defendant had razor blades in his pocket, the car, you know, when he was pulled over, he had stated that he didn't know anything about the car, it was his girlfriend's car, but that he was acting really nervous, and there was other evidence admitted that spoke to the fact that he knew that there were drugs in the vehicle, that he had drug paraphernalia on his person, and that he could have, you know, been in possession, at a minimum in possession.
Right, but does sufficiency of evidence, other evidence, answer the question as to whether or not that error would have been harmless with respect to a simple possession charge?
It would. Sufficiency of the evidence, can you ask the question again? I'm sorry.
Is sufficiency of the evidence the same as harmless error? Is because there's other sufficient evidence, does that necessarily render harmless any error about tying the amount to the knowing element?
No, I think it just contributes to the fact that the prosecutor, you know, while he did obviously rely substantially on the amount because there was such a great amount, I think there was plenty of other evidence for the jury to infer and or, you know, any fact finder to infer that the defendant knew of the drugs in his vehicle and therefore the error would have been harmless. Thank you.
I just want to restate something that I said earlier. Had Butler actually accompanied MJ Thomas in the weighing of this crack cocaine, if he knew anything about the weighing procedures, we probably wouldn't be here. I probably wouldn't have even raised this issue. But he didn't. He had zero involvement in the weighing, and I think that that's critical. As for the second issue, we were debating whether it says reasonable probability or possibility. I put in my brief from Kendrick V. Pippin, and this is a quote, information was improperly before the jury and that it posed a reasonable possibility of prejudice to the defendant. Now, I could have mistyped that, but if I didn't, then the standard is reasonable possibility, not probability. And that comes from our Supreme Court. That's a 2011 decision. As to the knowing possession, I know this court.
Are you suggesting we're bound by the Supreme Court?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm going to take your time.
Like I said in my first argument, the initial argument, the prosecution not only used the amount, the weight in this case, to evidence intent to distribute, that's very clear, But I think that this court should reverse completely and not give the prosecution the chance to enter an F6, because they also said this much cocaine equals knowing possession. A lesser amount may not equal knowing possession. You may not know that there's $600 to $700 of cocaine sitting on your seat if you're not allowed to know how much there is. In this case, had Butler not been allowed to testify improperly as to the weight, all the jury would have known was that there was an amount of testable crack cocaine in the car.
Yes, because it's been in the trial courts. Don't they still have this sample? Can't they weigh it today?
I assume they could. But I don't know. Maybe they could not procure MJ Thomas again, and maybe Butler gets up
there. They didn't weigh it today. Still there.
They probably could have weighed it on the stand if they wanted to, or they could have had Butler weigh it minutes before he testified, but they didn't do any of that. And I don't think it's fair necessarily to speculate what could or could not have happened or what they could or couldn't have done. The fact of the matter is we're dealing with what they didn't do, what they should have done, and what the consequences should be. And my point in saying that it's, in my opinion, unfair to remand it and allow the prosecution to choose between prosecuting on the F3 or just taking the F6 is that their case was built around knowing possession via the weight. And without the weight element, there may not be as strong a case for knowing possession.
I don't want to stand in the way of retrying the case, but I would think that if we remanded it back with orders to enter a conviction on felony 6, that would be to your client's advantage.
Well, it could be. They also could choose to dismiss. He's been in for quite a while. He got a 10-year sentence, and you know, I'm not sure if he made bond or not, but sometimes they choose just to dismiss. They may offer in a plea agreement to an F6, I don't know, but my position at this point is that the proper remedy would be reversal in total.
When you say reversal in total, you're suggesting that there wouldn't be a remand for a new trial?
No, there would be a retrial.
I'll need to clarify that.
And then they would be able to have Butler weigh it or find MJ Thomas. If they chose to do so. Thank you very much.
Case will be deemed submitted. We thank both counsel for their arguments today.